Good morning, New Mexico. Welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting from the Santa Fe Baking Company, streaming on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services, and we're at facebook.com/radiocafe. I'd like now to welcome to the program Flip Nicklin. He's a journalist and photographer for National Geographic. He is the co-founder of the Whale Trust. He's a member of many distinguished conservation organizations. And tonight he will be at the Lensic at 7 o'clock here in Santa Fe doing a presentation called Among Giants, A Life with Whales. Welcome to the Radio Cafe.
Great to be here.
So it's really true. You have spent a life with whales. You come from a long line of people who were in the water and involved with whales, involved with diving, going back to your great-great-grandparents?
Well, my great-great-grandfather was a whaler, but also was giving lectures in the late 1800s about the demise of whales and talking about how much had changed. My grandfather was a commercial diver, building piers and bridges and such. My dad ran a dive shop and is today running adventure dive trips around the world. And we were going to be divers. We didn't know what we were going to do, but it was going to be wet.
And so you started diving. You worked in your dad's dive shop. You started diving at an early age. And at a certain point, you picked up a camera and you started doing underwater photography.
My father rode a whale, and this changed everything. And so probably the biggest thing for me, and that was 1963, and I wasn't there, but he went out with some friends. He just inherited some underwater cameras, a 16-millimeter film camera and a still camera. We had whales off in front of San Diego, but whales were, you know, puffs of smoke in the distance. That's all we thought. But this whale was stopped, and it turned out to be a Brutus whale whose tail was caught in the anchor line to a gillnet. And they jumped in with it, swam around it. They had spear guns. They didn't know what it was going to do. This was before Save the Whales or any of that stuff was going on. And they had cameras. So they took still pictures. They took movie pictures. And then my dad climbed up on the back of the whale and had a picture waving to the camera, which got published in the paper and all the papers across the country. And then the late night variety show after the late news, run at the time by Regis Philbin in San Diego, invited him to come on and show the stories. They sent the film off to Goodson Todman Productions in New York, and my dad was on a celebrity game show called To Tell the Truth, and he was the guy telling the truth, and Bates Littlehales from National Geographic, their underwater guy, their top underwater photographer, saw the show, was just starting to think about doing whales in the wild at the time, and got in contact with my dad. My dad was a whale expert. He'd seen one. That changed everything for us, and from then on, whales became a bigger deal for us.
Now, I think it's an important part of the story also that your dad freed the whale from that net.
Exactly. I mean, after they did all the stuff, he dived down, and free diving, all this was snorkeling, dived down, took the line off the tail of the whale, and the whales swam away and appeared to be fine.
And that was considered dangerous, and I think it's also, it's really important. I mean, the amount of change that there has been in the attitude toward whales in just the last 40, 50 years is huge. I mean, we think of Moby Dick, you think of killer whales being scary, and this whole idea of whales as both monstrous predators and also prey, going from that to being these magnificent creatures who are endangered, who are vulnerable, who are beautiful, who sing.
Well, that whole thing, I mean, whales were monsters. Whales were, you know, breathing fire in the ocean, and then they were a commodity. And for the longest time, they were just a commodity. And it wasn't until 1940 at National Geographic they ran a story talking about the natural history of whales, mostly paintings. And my father was on the beginning of that change of our attitude towards whales and get to the sort of myth and magic and glorified beautiful pictures of whales, and we got to save them. When I came in the late 70s, it was with a bunch of graduate students. They were sort of going for the myth and magic to the scientific study, going, if we're going to do the right thing around whales, we have to know what they are, what they need, what they're doing, not just as a dream, but in real, more scholarly approach to finding out who they are and what they do.
So how did you actually start? You've been with National Geographic for a very long time.
Well, I came in because of Bates from National Geographic. I started teaching National Geographic photographers how to dive. And they'd come to San Diego, and I'd teach them how to dive, and sort of specialty courses, how to dive with cameras and things. I'd done a couple little jobs. I knew I wanted to shoot. I knew I wanted to do stuff, and I wanted to do it for National Geographic. But in 1979, my father hired me to come along He was doing an IMAX film in Hawaii. He'd done a number of films. He'd done a bunch of whale things, including a 1972 story, which is the first wild whale story for National Geographic.
And that was the very beginning of the IMAX thing.
Oh, this was the first whale thing for IMAX. It was all new stuff, and I came to do production stills. And it was great. Now, the first time I dived with whales, and the graduate students there were like 15 young people doing their graduate work, unpublished stuff, that were, again, treating whales as a biological study, and I liked these guys a lot. One of the things that happened is they were studying singing humpback whales, and they knew they sang, they recorded the song, they knew they could identify individuals with pictures of the tail, but on March 10th, 1979, they were above a Singer and looked down. They just assumed Singers swam along singing and you saw them once in a while. On that day, they looked down. They could see the Singer down below. So Jim Darling, who I still work with today, said, can you dive down, free dive down with no bubbles, dive under the tail and take a picture of the genitals of this whale so we can find out if it's a boy or a girl? And I said, maybe. And and I did. And it was wonderful and terrifying. Diving down, the sound they're singing, the level is maybe 160 decibels. It's tremendously loud. And you sort of feel it in your air spaces rather than hearing it. And as I tucked down under the tail, and it was very, very loud, getting close enough to take that picture, out of the corner of my eye, I could see the tail coming up above me. And every horror story of whales was there. And what the whale was really doing was not going to slap me with his tail, but he was looking back under his pectoral to see what was back there, because I was probably tickling bubbles up into his genitals, and he wanted to know what was going on there. We found out it was a male, and that was the beginning of my scientific diving.
Now, let's talk just for a moment about this whole bubbles thing and free diving, because I didn't even know what that was until I read your book. By the way, there's a wonderful book, not to mention an iPad book, that accompanies this lecture that you were doing tonight at the Lensic. The book is called Among Giants, A Life with Whales, and has beautiful illustrations and a whole narrative of your life. And one thing I learned from that book was that free diving means basically taking a deep breath, going down, and in your case, taking pictures and coming back up without blowing any bubbles.
Exactly. And I was a free diver. I was a competitive spear fisherman in the day. And that was a big part of diving as a kid for me. We scuba dived too, and I taught scuba diving. But free diving, I loved free diving. Marine mammals use bubbles for a bunch of things, and one of the things is for agonistic displays and blowing up to show that they're displeased or they're showing how powerful they are. So going up and blowing bubbles in the face of marine mammals, especially if they weigh 80,000 pounds or more, probably isn't a great idea. It disturbs things. And so to dive down, free diving, if the idea is to shoot behavior and not change it, it was a great tool, and it was fast. I mean, you're going along in a boat. Mostly I'm shooting over the shoulders of research. And then there's a moment, maybe 5 minutes, maybe 10 minutes of cool stuff. Getting in the water, getting a picture, and getting out was really important. And I could put on fins, mask, and snorkel and go to work, not take a lot of time putting on specialty gear.
You worked hand-in-hand all your career and are still working with scientists. And I think one thing that's so interesting and important to talk about is how your work really furthers theirs, and theirs furthers yours. In other words, scientists need photographers, and photographers work with scientists.
Well, and at the time, that was exactly it. I mean, that from that first day when Jim Darling said, come over here, we could use these pictures. And most of the researchers at the time weren't underwater guys. They were surface guys. They were boat guys. And to take the camera down into where things were happening and bring back a picture, it was great stuff, and especially film at the time, when having a 16-millimeter camera on a boat was a big deal, not like video today. So that at the time was really rare stuff, to be a diver with these guys, have them say, we'd like to see this, can you get a picture of it, whether it was diving down with a singing humpback whale or seeing killer whales on rubbing beaches go by. They were putting them in the right place. They had the right questions. I helped them document the answers, and we all, I hope, came out very well because of it.
What are rubbing beaches?
We had heard from people I met on the Hawaii job. They were working with killer whales up in Vancouver Island. And there was one place that the killer whales went by. There's a bunch of kinds of killer whales. There's fish-eating killer whales and the marine mammal-eating killer whales. number of other different groups and cultures of killer whales. But the fish eaters would go eating salmon all day, and then they'd sneak up when they got ahead of the game, probably, and they'd go to these smooth stone rocks, these little coves, and they'd scratch their bottoms and backs and genitals on these smooth stones. The year before I went up, a researcher had tried to photograph that with a rebreather and had actually died when he was doing that. We tried to figure a way to get in. You couldn't just walk in the water or all the whales would leave. But I figured if I could get into a little crack and ease down there and crawl across on the bottom when I came into the situation, that might work, and it did. It was very exciting. When I was a kid in San Diego, if you saw killer whales where you're diving, you got out of the water. You waved down a boat because they were going to get you. And these guys were saying, nah, they're not going to think you're a seal. They're going to know you're something different. The line I really loved was, they're not going to hurt you by mistake.
Right.
But I could go down, I could crawl out to the edge of this little path of smooth stones, and the killer whales would come 3 or 4 feet away from me, scratching themselves, going by, and paying no attention to me. And at the time, like many of these pictures, it was the first underwater pictures of killer whales doing this kind of thing.
We're talking to Flip Nicklin. You got in on this work at a time when, well, I guess it's still a time when scientists don't know very much about whales, but particularly at the beginning, pretty much everything was being discovered.
Well, it was great. There was very, very little work done. And these young researchers had done things, but they hadn't published them yet. So getting out there and coordinating with their first publishings, it was like a lot of the stuff they were talking about was thought of as voodoo science. And these same young researchers, the grad students at the time, are now pillars of the scientific community. So to tell their stories first, and I, the first time I put a proposal into National Geographic, it's 1980, and they said, no, maybe we've done whales. They'd done 3 stories. I thought that was all that people really wanted to know. That's 18 stories ago for National Geographic, because the story kept changing because of the science.
Why was it called voodoo science?
Well, it's just that, you know, they were upending all the thoughts of the previous generations who had, people didn't believe you could individually identify whales. They thought you had to, the old way to identify whales, they put a discovery tag, shot it into a whale, and then when you cleaned it on the harvesting boat, you found out where it was. Then went from that to knowing the tails of a humpback whale or the fin of a killer whale and being able to identify the animals. The things that changed, like in Vancouver Island, they thought there were 3,000 killer whales going around Vancouver Island. They talked about putting machine guns in there because they ate so many salmon. When they went through, a guy named Mike Big went through and ID'd all the animals there, it was less than 300. It changed everything. It changed the attitude towards the whales. It quit live captures of whales in the area. And this was happening at a growing pace as more and more of the new science, the new benign types of science, took over. But it was displacing some other stuff.
Let's go back to this question about singing. Do we know at this point why whales sing, who sings, when they sing, what their songs are about?
We know more all the time. That's my main study with Jim Darling, and since 1996 we've been back there working every year. One of the first things we found out was that singers are males. And so the assumption was immediately that they're calling females over to them. Well, that doesn't happen. The animals that come up to singers are other males. And 20% of the time, most of the time they bounce off, one stays, one leaves, but 20% of the time they go off together and they're going to a female. So the singer wants to be with a female, but he's getting cohorts to go with him. So you end up with this bunch of whales chasing a female, but it's not a free-for-all. It's more likely like the Tour de France, where there are a few champions in there with their affiliates, and the song is probably a coordinating mechanism to get those affiliates to come in. And that's our hypothesis at the time. We know it's not a bunch of things, but that's as close as we've come. We have seen half a dozen males around a female where they're all on the same side. There's no battle at all. It's all working together. So and we go every year and pin it down a little bit more. We're working on a bunch of playback experiments right now to see the effects of song. And it's, again, you go out 100 days and you get 4 or 5 little jumps forward. But you're finding, I used to be frustrated. There was all this stuff that you sort of knew, but you had to prove it, and it took a while. And Jim Darling would say, how cool is it to be out there knowing stuff nobody else knows yet? And it's very much fun.
And some of that you broke in National Geographic before it was even in the scientific journals.
We did, and that's a problem. Because you've got it doesn't help the researcher to have the stuff scooped in Geographic. So as I got to understand the situations better, I think we got much better at coordinating, so we came out at the same time, and everybody got their success out of it without tripping over each other. And I was asking a lot. I was asking people to share those stories with me that they'd put their lives into, and to have that relationship, I took it very, very seriously.
And you had a real ethic of staying out of their way, being helpful, staying in the background until you were needed, and that made for lifelong relationships.
Well, exactly. There were small boats and small camps and little funding, and you're trying to talk your way onto these little tight quarters to go along. And yes, and to go along, and I'm a big guy, and cameramen have a fairly assertive personality sometimes, to try and go along and go, I'm going to be out of your way, but I'm going to be here when you need me. It got better over time. The more I did it, the better it got. And I think I got a reputation for respecting, and I really do. I'm in awe of the guys who do the research. When the title Among Giants is as much the giants of research as giant whales.
Are whales found in every ocean? Is there any place where they're not found?
They're just about everywhere. I mean, oceans and seas, and if you're cetaceans, so you've got dolphins up rivers, and the Ganges, and the Amazon, and the Rio de Plata. So yes, they're just about everywhere.
And there's a lot of different kinds of them. Some of them are endangered. Some of them are doing, I guess, a little better.
Yeah, and I think that's one of the things. That there are some successes, but certainly I think marine mammals in general, I just got a statistic that 23% are endangered right now, which is not nearly as bad as it used to be. And our main animals, humpback whales, when I started in Hawaii, the whole North Pacific probably had around, this is 1979, probably had around 2,000 whales. And now it's more than 20,000.
Humpback whales.
Humpback whales. So it's a tremendous comeback. And somewhere the questions will change, going, can we save them, to how are we going to live with them? They're going to want to be places we live. They're going to eat things we eat. And we have to decide, not just the whales, but I think they're a great icon for the question of how will we deal with the wild. Do we want a wilderness out there? And what will we share to keep that wilderness going?
It seems like that kind of question is one we haven't done so well with on land. In the sea, I mean, it's a different set of questions because we don't build shopping malls and things like that in the middle of the ocean.
Yeah, I agreed. And we do build marinas. There are whales going back into San Diego Bay. And San Diego Bay, the south part of San Diego Bay, was a whale lagoon. It was a breeding lagoon. And my great-great-grandfather, Philip Crosthwaite, talked about how there were so many whales back there when he first came in the 1840s that it was unsafe to take a small boat across to a freshwater spring. So as whales come back, they will look, they will poke into those places, and I think man has to be part of the equation, but it can't be all of the equation.
What do we know about their migratory patterns? And I guess it may be different for different kinds of whales, but do they travel long distances, for example?
We know more all the time, and we've done a number of things with both matching tails. In 1979, Jim took the tail pictures of humpbacks from Hawaii and went to Juneau, Alaska, and met with a young science teacher there who had the same kinds of tail pictures, and found out they were the same whales. So we could match whales with that.
The same individuals?
Same individuals. And so we knew that they were in the winter, they were breeding and mating and calving in Hawaii. In the summer, they were feeding up in Juneau and southeast Alaska. And we were starting to make those connections around. We found out through matching that it takes about 31 days for them to make the 3,000-mile trip from Alaska to Hawaii. We've also done it with satellite tags and measured. And it turns out it's just about the same, around 31 days. We put more and more of those tags on. And every time we do, we find out it's more complicated than we thought it was. Last year, there's a population of gray whales along our west coast that seem to be doing very well. They've recovered. They're probably more than 20,000. There's another very, very small population off of Russia that's less than 150. And we got one satellite tag on one of those whales last year, Bruce Mate from Oregon State University, and it didn't go anywhere. We were expecting it to go to some lagoon on the Asian coast somewhere. When it left, it went north and east, went into the Bering Sea, went through the Aleutians, and joined the migration off of our west coast at about Oregon near Newport. And there are two tags already this year from Oregon State University. So we're finding out all kinds of stuff. Those whales were crossing big ocean basins. We knew that gray whales hug the coast. Well, they don't. So what we know changes every year. The tools get better. There's a great description saying by a researcher at National Geographic, saying in the last 35 years, we sort of discovered a new continent. And the next generation gets to find out what's in the interior. It's a very exciting time to take them.
We're talking to Flip Nicklin. His presentation is called Among Giants, A Life with Whales. That's at the Lensic tonight at 7 o'clock. How many different kinds of whales are there? Or do we know for sure how many different species of whales there are?
Depends on how you break it up. And the taxonomy is in the air. We're discussing right now whether there are six types of killer whales or one. You know, but over 80, 86, depending on how you break the thing up, but quite a few.
And killer whales, they're one of those species whose reputation has also changed quite radically.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I think what Pliny the Elder described them as sort of teeth, muscle, and bad attitude, and an enemy to all whales. And when I took those pictures in the rubbing beaches, I had nice pictures of whales going by underwater, and I showed them when I went to the Antarctic on a job that same year. And the safety officers were not at all happy because they were afraid people would get killed by being close to killer whales when they knew they would kill anything around them. So our attitudes have changed tremendously over that time. And they're all things. They're wonderful animals and curious and benign, and they're also really successful and efficient top-end predators. Sometimes they eat fish. Sometimes they're not chasing other whales and very happy with them around. But in the spring, there's a place called False Pass where more than 100 transient marine mammal eaters wait for gray whales and babies to come through, and that's a killing ground. So it's sort of like people. They're poets and they're mass murderers and everything in between.
There are some amazing species. One of them is called the narwhal.
Narwhals are great. That was my first trip to the Arctic, and I grew up in San Diego. My family's been in San Diego forever, and I'm sure my grandmother wouldn't have suggested going diving on oceans you can walk on. And I went up there. I went
29 degree water, you were saying?
Yeah,
in the book.
Yeah. It's very chilly. And I went with John Ford. John Ford was one of the humpback whale guys in Hawaii when I went there. He was one of the researchers. He was with killer whales when I went to do killer whales, and he was going to look at narwhals. We went up to the flow edge near Pond Inlet and went out to the edge to see whales, and I was fascinated. I didn't know what I was doing. We had all this different kinds of gear, and you're sitting on 6 feet of ice waiting for the whales to come close. And at one point, they called... The people I was with had to go. They had to leave. But I wanted to stay, and my guide said he could be back in 3 or 4 hours, not to worry about it. Well, he was gone for 3 days. And I'm out at this Lancaster Sound. It's as wild a place as you can imagine. There's polar bears and all the stuff that's there. And I don't know what I'm doing. And finally, in the middle of a sleep, it's 24-hour sun, but I was sleeping, and I heard the tent start to rustle. I'm sure it was a polar bear. And it was an Inuit wildlife officer, Siglik Kakiagruk. And Siglik was looking in going, you have to leave. And I said, no, I'm from National Geographic. I have the permits. He said, no, where you are isn't going to be here tomorrow. You have to leave. And I packed all my stuff and followed him. I'd never driven a snow machine before, so I had to follow him with dragging a boat and all until we got to a gravel strip. And when I woke up after a good sleep, there were 20 miles of ice was gone. And I decided I needed somebody to take care of me and had really good relationships with a wildlife officer up there named Glenn Williams and Andrew Tuktu, an Inuit hunter. He was the good neighbor Sam. He was a Jacques Cousteau, this wonderful young guy who I worked with for many years up there.
Your dad had an expression, I can't remember it exactly, but something like, you can't take pictures if you're dead.
Yeah, she said, if you get dead, you don't take any more good pictures. And that was not lost on me at all, especially working up there and working in different places. And working in places where pictures were really hard fought. On that first narwhal story, I was there after 3.5 months. The film review was nothing usable yet. I was sure my career was over. And in 7 hours of one day, we got involved with this big fight of two narwhals and a female fighting off all these other males that went on for hours and hours and made for lots of pictures. And we were working out of a kayak, diving out of kayaks in this cold water. And everything happened in that time. It was a great success. And But that whole time, when you're swimming around with animals with 10-foot tusks out in front of them, you have great respect for the power and the armament they have.
Well, that's the thing about these narwhals, is that they're, you call them the unicorns of the whale species. They have these swords coming out of there.
And they are the unicorn. If you go to Europe and look at a unicorn tusk cup was supposed to filter poisons, that's a narwhal tusk. So they made it through trading down, but all the horns of the unicorn that are in collections come from narwhals.
So one of the things that's really, I mean, there were a couple of times when I was reading your book where I almost jumped out of my skin, because, for example, there's one photograph of a person in a kayak with complete gear, and the whole back of the kayak is out of the water on the head of a whale. I was terrified just looking at the picture.
Oh, we were terrified, too. And that was Carrie Finley, in 1994, and the first time bowhead whales, these big, big whales. The whales that we still hunt, the U.S. still hunts bowhead whales, the Inupiat population in northern Alaska. And because of that, they're very, very cautious around people. Any noise we made, any time, we certainly couldn't use a motor of any kind. And that year, for some reason, they hung around and they would hang their tail over you and hang their pectoral over you and pick you up on their head. But they didn't seem aggressive at all. And at one point, I was standing up shooting pictures in a two-man kayak and had a young man, William, behind me, who was very nervous about being around the whales, and for good reason. And I said, well, if you get nervous, lean over towards the outrigger, it'll stabilize the boat. And all of a sudden, the boat starts to lean very heavily to one side, and I looked back and went, William, what's happening? He pointed in, there's this big eye about 4 feet underwater looking at you, and you're trying to put your gear away real quick, you know.
Did you land in the water?
No. Everything was fine. The whale never touched us. He was just hanging there looking at us. But something happened. After years of working up there, Carrie Finley had been up there for years, and all of a sudden, that year, the whales changed their behavior towards the kayaks. And, I mean, in the years up there, working with belugas, working with bowheads, working with narwhals, it was just, this was before climate change was such a big issue. And so it was opening up places and doing stories where there were very few other people doing them at the time in a wonderful part of the world.
We're talking to National Geographic journalist and photographer Flip Nicklin. He will be at the Lensic tonight at 7 o'clock. His presentation is called Among Giants, A Life with Whales. Now let's talk about some of the dangers that whales and indeed dolphins and other marine mammals face. There's all kinds of problems like nets and pollution and habitat loss and noise.
Well, exactly. And I think that as we looked at our relationship with whales, and it changed, you know, we in the 1980s, we started the moratorium that we weren't going to hunt whales, and we dramatically cut. There's still some hunting, but it's a shadow of what it used to be. But in the 1990s, I did a story called Dolphins in Crisis and started to focus on those other issues besides hunting with whales. Their habitat issues, their issues with us eating the same prey they eat, pollution, noise pollution, all of those are big things for whales. They're also often very complicated issues that sometimes get answered in sort of marketing campaigns in 30 seconds that are a little confusing. I think in trying to get people to spend a little more time on some of these subjects, it's really worthwhile. My grandfather used to say that life was a game of chess where people think they're playing checkers, and and it really fits in here. These are complex questions, and sometimes we give them too simple an answer.
So let's talk, for example, about the tuna nets that snare dolphins. That's a big problem.
That was one of our the pull bycatch issue, and I think that's where dolphins and whales, since we decided we were going to protect them, they're great icons for these issues because it goes beyond dolphins to turtles and everything else. But exactly, and going through dolphin safe tuna, and I see that's in the news again today, what can be called dolphin safe, and that idea that we don't want to sacrifice cetaceans when we're fishing for other things, and that's a big thing. Wasting, the amount of waste we have in bycatch and some of the fishing techniques we have is sort of unsustainable and not smart.
What about pollution? What are the worst sources of pollution in terms of whales? Well, whales and dolphins.
Well, it's really hard. Some of the complicated things. Well, I did belugas, and belugas in the Gulf of St. Lawrence is one of those places where whales were dying, and tumors were a big issue, and there were things that were banned in the 60s, ant poisons and things dumped in the Great Lakes. They were leaching into systems, and other critters were eating them, and it was affecting them. It's also sometimes more complicated. We think about pollution a lot in the Washington area for killer whales. The southern residents, they're called, around the north end of Washington, south part of Vancouver Island. And there, pollution is certainly an issue, but it's in a food-stressed population. Those animals have had their main food, Chinook or king salmon, really taken away from them, and they have more issues with pollution. In the same area, there are marine mammal-eating killer whales that have much higher levels of pollution that are doing pretty well. So it's in conjunction with other issues, and sometimes we jump on the most emotional and don't always get to the most important.
So whales that are hungry tend not to do as well in toxic environments.
In all those situations where you look at those the real studies, and it's in a food stress population. These other things are big, but you have to get back to food stress. If you want to solve the question, you got to work on the food issue, and the other stuff will drift away.
To what extent has the environmental movement, which has certainly done a lot to help whale and dolphin populations, at least in some places, to what extent has it really been able to make a difference in the face of rising population on the earth that wants to, for example, eat a whole lot of salmon?
Well, I think you've hit the major thing. Is restraint probably isn't a great human trait. And that's the big issue. And somewhere, if you want to have other things, you have to decide to use less for our species. And it's a question. It's a choice. I mean, we can. I think that the fact that we've made such a clear statement, we think the wild is important. We think whales and dolphins are important. And you get to this conflict, and it's worth discussing and going, we need a bigger philosophy. We need to decide what we're going to eat, what we're not going to eat, what other animals we want around, what kind of a world we want to be in. And it's a serious discussion. It's not something that gets done in 30 seconds. To me, however you get into it, however you get excited about it, whether it's through religion, whether it's through science, whether it's through philosophy or politics, once you get into it, it's worth digging in and really thinking about it in long discussion. And they're happening. They may not be what comes in the flyer to ask for $10, but those discussions do happen. And there's a great example I have. At one point, there were two researchers, I won't use names, but they were discussing how many whales could be taken in northern Alaska. And one was very, very animal rights, and one was working for the community and very much working for the people doing the hunt. And in that discussion, the numbers were, the animal rights person was saying no more than 94, and the person from the hunt saying no more than 97. So you can do something there. If it's all or nothing, well, that's a whole different deal. But if you're working with the science, and those are the people I feel most comfortable with, though I certainly believe there's lots of other ways to look at whales and dolphins.
Well, as some of your scientists point out, whom you've worked with, that there are real questions about, for example, how many animals you need to keep a viable population, and that's a real issue, because when populations get reduced, even if you then make their areas closed to hunting,
yes,
and fishing and those kinds of things, maybe the population can't bounce back because other animals have filled those ecological niches.
Exactly. And the complication, too, and I think that the hardest chapter 5 in the book, talking about the future, where we go, what we do. And it's not just sustainability, though that's a great argument, but it's also the morality and the ethics, and they're all valid, but you just have to be clear which one you're talking about at the time. But the sustainability, yes, the issues are complex, and just like the stuff we just said with gray whales, we're the science, we need to know more, not just how many there are, but how they live their lives. And I think there's a big transition with some of the recoveries with going, there are a few animals we're starting to know quite a bit about, like humpback whales I worked with a lot. It'd be nice to really have the will to really figure out how a few of these animals live, and through that get a better idea of bigger pictures for bigger populations.
You started an organization called the Whale Trust. What's that all about?
Well, that was very great. In I had a chance to sell my photo collection in the late 90s when people really wanted to buy that kind of stuff for real money. And it was a good deal. And I came up with enough walking around money that I called Jim Darling, the first researcher I worked with in Hawaii in 79, and said, let's go back to Hawaii and see if it's worthwhile working there. And ever since then, we've been working in Hawaii every year, working on breeding populations and social behavior of whales in the breeding grounds, starting with Jim and the work we've been doing on Song, and then with Megan Jones, who came in and said, well, you've been looking for 30 years at males. Maybe someone should look at females in the breeding population. And she just got her PhD. So I get to be junior scientist and chief beggar for them trying to raise funds. And it's most of the time I was trying to find the guy who knows to go out with. And in the stuff in Hawaii, I'm one of the guys who knows, and that feels very, very good.
Are there a lot of female whale researchers at this point?
Yeah, there are quite a few. And Denise Herzing just has a great book out called Dolphin Diaries, about 25 years with spotted dolphins off of the Bahamas. I just mentioned Megan Jones, who's doing her work. Mo Brown, working with right whales off of the East Coast. And yes, there are some great female researchers.
I can't believe they'd only studied male whales. It's just like human medicine.
We had one little question, you know, and we knew there was other stuff to it. But the way science tends to be is you work in a very tight world. And my job, and the lucky thing of my job, is I got to go from person to person to person. So I got to be the honeybee moving all around and got the big overview. And that's a luxury most researchers don't really have.
Very interesting. Now, you have in the back of your book something that you call your photo rules. So taking pictures of whales, even though there aren't all that many people doing it, you still have to be careful not to take a kind of typical whale picture because they won't print it.
Well, exactly. You have to do new stuff. You have to, and that's where the science. Sometimes you're taking the same picture, but it means a lot more because now you know what it means. My dad was starting shooting. They got any picture of a whale going by, and then you said everything you knew about whales. And when he came out with us in the end of the 90s, and we took him to look at this behavior and that behavior, and he said, were they always doing all this stuff? Because they were just looking for any way you could be close to a whale. And we are much more, I mean, my typical day is you go out and you find a singer or you find a breath-holding female, and you stay there for the day. And very often, nothing happens all day long, and once in a while, wonderful things happen and you make a picture of it.
So you have to really be ready in these long days of hurry up and wait, just sitting there all day long. You have to have that, you have to basically be ready and on call at a second's notice.
You have to enjoy the process. You have to enjoy being out there in the boat. And in the morning, we're out there early in the morning with a cup of coffee and there's a whale sitting next to the boat breathing. It's a great way to start the day. And whether you make a picture or not, it's like going fishing. You go out there for the whole day. If you don't enjoy being out there, you're in the wrong game.
Right.
And we work with really good people, and most of it's sort of inane conversation. And then, like that, things move, and great things happen, and that recharges you for another month.
There has been a tremendous improvement in diving technology and in photographic technology. And as, I mean, you were a young buck in your 20s going underwater and being able to not breathe and not blow bubbles for minutes at a time and so on. Now, there is equipment that kind of compensates for that.
Oh, yeah. And I think the remote systems, things like Critter Cam, where they put the camera on the animal and they take pictures of their own group, tremendous stuff. And I think the rebreathers and the new technology is going to be tremendous as we move forward. Digital cameras. I mean, the fact that you can have hundreds of pictures in your camera and don't have to take it apart every 36 frames. I mean, you kill yourself to get close to something really exciting, then you have to go to the back, take the camera apart, hope it didn't leak, put it back together, and get back again. And every time I'm envious of the new gear and the new toys that new guys get to use, I think of the guys before me out there with a view camera with really heavy stuff and very few frames. It's a process, and we built on the guys before us, like Bates Little Hales, and the guys after us learned from us, and I don't see it slowing down. I think I just want to keep going out there and see where we go, because we're going to find out wonderful things.
In your presentation, I mean, you're mainly a still photographer, but there are also some moving images, which, amazingly enough, also appear on the iPad version of your book, Among Giants, A Life with Whales. Will you be showing tonight, will you be showing some of the movies of whales?
There's a young man named Jason Sturgis who works with me, and his video, his high-definition video, and some of my older stuff will be in, and especially at the beginning, before people settle in, we'll be having running that as people are coming in, and it's beautiful, beautiful stuff. And yes, it's Jason and I are usually on the same boat in both shooting stills and video, and I am becoming Jason's assistant at this point. He came to me 10 years ago and wanted to do anything to get in there. I gave him everything I could to discourage him. He would never go away, and he's going to be a wonderful talent. He is a wonderful talent, but with a video camera rather than with a still camera.
And so there's a whole new generation of people who are coming into this field, both as scientists and as journalists and photographers.
Oh, yes. And mentoring a few folks. I have a young woman in Juneau, Alaska. Her father's a whale-watching captain. She's a whale-watching captain at 17. And Jaylene Beadle. And I think she's going to be wonderful if she doesn't decide to go off and be a surgeon or something. But helping young people get started, and especially if they're interested in whales, is great, great fun.
So you actually stick cameras to whales?
Oh, yeah. A guy named Greg Marshall came up with this years ago at National Geographic. And with a suction cup, they stick whales, seals, sharks, penguins, and have the camera go along and give you sort of the point of view of the animal going aloft. In where I live in Alaska is the feeding area. And we have these big groups of whales that make a corral of bubbles and drive herring into it and feed, and they put a critter cam on one of the young whales. It wasn't part of the feeding. It was still taking milk from mom, but it swam along looking at this whole thing, so you get to look over that whale's shoulder at the things going on, and that kind of stuff is very, very exciting.
How do you have enough light you just don't go that far underwater when you're taking those kinds of photographs?
Well, the tools now, again, are so much better. When I started, I was shooting Kodachrome 64, and it was, you're always just on the edge of possibility. 64 ASA, now I'm shooting at 3000 ISO on the new digital cameras, and it's a piece of cake. And it sees through blue better. So, no, the digital stuff, and who knows where it's going to go. The rumors of the next level of cameras coming out are through the roof as far as how much sensitivity you have.
Did you ever have a moment where you were terrified for your life?
Oh, very often. Yeah, usually going in to see the editor. my first director of photography was this wonderful guy. Yeah, we just had a get-together with him a couple of years ago, Bob Gilka. And he was the director of photography, and on his wall going into the office was, "Please wipe your knees before entering."
Right. Yeah, he sounds like a scary guy.
He was most wonderful guy, and always wanted, I mean, he loved the families, he loved trying to take care of people, and still does, but he had your full attention when you went in there as a newbie, certainly.
No, but seriously, I mean, out in the field, out in the water.
Yeah, a number of times, and seriously, if you work with big, powerful animals, no matter how much you love them, no matter how much you love them, they bump into you and it hurts a lot, and when you have an 80,000-pound animal accidentally hit you with a pectoral or find out what you are with a pectoral, it's a black and blue marker on your arm. When that narwhal has its tusk trying to figure what you are, friend or foe, it has your full attention. And I've never been seriously hurt, but I've been very cautious. And I go to my dad's thing, if you get dead, there's no more good pictures. And you have to be sensible. You have to be realistic about what chances you take. I treat all of these big animals as strange dogs. I love dogs. But a big, strange dog, I'm going to be careful as I get to know that animal.
Let's go back to the question of hunting just for a moment, because I think it's important. I mean, you're making it sound like hunting is really a minor problem in terms of whale populations compared to pollution and some of these other things. Does hunting make sense at this point?
I think it's a very complicated issue, and I take it that way. And it's also a really emotional issue. And I would love for us not to kill whales, not to kill whales and dolphins. Covering that, and different cultures see things different ways. When you get beyond management issues of whales, that you're not talking about endangered status, it's a tough thing. I personally would like it to stop, but I can understand countries not wanting you to change their cultural views for non-management issues.
Well, it seems like there's a big difference between Japanese commercial whaling on the one hand and Inuit villages hunting one whale and having a whole historical ritualistic relationship with that whale.
I agree. And at the same time, I think we may demonize the Japanese a little bit, and we may glorify the Inuit a little bit. And probably there's a little bit on both sides trying to get and work close. A thing that happened to me, I was trying to cover this as a journalist. I was trying to tell all sides of things and be respectful of all sides. And I was trying to get on a Norwegian hunting boat for minke whales. And these people were primarily cod fishermen. They're going to go out. And finally the captain said, well, okay, you can come. You can come on our boat and tell our story. You just have to promise that your pictures and story won't hurt me, my family, or my community. And, of course, I didn't go. And so that's serious stuff, you know, and they're not horrible people. I think some of the commercial stuff, I think it goes beyond the hunting and into sovereignty issues and all kinds of other stuff. And I hope it's going to stop. And I think the young people in a bunch of the places aren't nearly as interested. It's hard to get the facts, but I'm not trying to minimize how much it affects people on the hunting and affects the animals on the hunting, but we're taking a small number compared to what we were, and most of the populations we're hunting are not highly endangered. So it's a serious issue, but it's an ethics and morality issue. Usually it's not a sustainability issue. Yeah, it's tough. I mean, I've worked with folks, you know, and again, like if you're working in a community that makes $600 per capita, getting a narwhal and a tusk is a big, big deal to them. It is something you can sympathize. And like any hunting, you tend to focus on the depending which side you're on, whether the importance of it or the waste of it. I could sit here with you for an hour and just talk about the elements of it, and we'd still probably go away with sort of, you know, it's tough with me. I'm against it. I would like it to stop. I respect the reasons in some communities why it doesn't stop.
We're talking to Flip Nicklin. His presentation at the Lensic tonight is called Among Giants, A Life with Whales. It's at 7 o'clock, and you will be giving a lecture. You will be showing some of these magnificent pictures of whales and some of the moving footage of whales. And this book, a very fine edition, is also available with your photography in it. Are you still out on the water? You still doing your photography?
Oh yeah. Oh no. I've got a bunch of whale pictures from this year. I'm big in Facebook, and I try to put whale pictures up. I just came bound from Sitka, Alaska, to Seattle in a boat, and we were with Pacific whiteside dolphins and killer whales and feeding humpback whales, and I do that about 2 months a year through National Geographic expeditions and Lindblad expeditions, and take people with you. So you're out there with 60 or 100 people with you, showing what you've seen for all the years. And I spend 2 or 3 months a year in Hawaii working with Whale Trust, trying to push things ahead. I'm also on the road more, telling stories and talking about it more. But it's trying to get other people out on the boats as well as myself.
Are you hopeful for the future of marine mammals?
Oh, I think so. I think we have. I think we're in a good track. I think that the whales, like humpback whales, like gray whales, have every chance of making a big, big comeback. And I think it's going to be a big part of us. I think they're going to be a great icon that goes beyond whales going, to me, the big new question is what are these lives like? How do they fit into this bigger world, the wild world of oceans? But it's also fish. It's big things like ocean acidification. And I mean, if you think losing a population of whales is scary, losing krill is terrifying. So that's where I say some of these bigger issues are much scarier than hunting, dramatic, emotional. But some of these bigger environmental issues scare the heck out of you, where you could have major shifts in populations.
Flip Nicklin, thank you so much for being with us.
Yeah, it's been a real pleasure.
You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're streaming live on the web at ksfr.org, podcasting at santafe.radiocafe.org. Thanks to Dotfoil Computer Services. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes. You can find us at facebook.com/radiocafe, and my email address is radiocafe@ksfr.org. Stay tuned for the BBC, then local news, then jazz.